Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-hosts, teacher and socialist Annie Lipson and community organizer and socialist Kenny Cepeda. We're online at what-s-left.webnode.com. Today, we will be discussing the recent pact or agreement between the United Arab Emirates and Israel as it relates to the annexation of Palestine, and in the context, maybe, of the Democratic Convention and current events, given that last week we've discussed some of it with Joe Biden's vice presidential candidate, Kamala Harris. I was afraid about how I pronounce that name, by the way, because there is a specific way, and just a side note, because it's on the news right now about how she, Trump went after the way he talked about her name. Tangent. So we hopefully will discuss that in that context. There's a lot of uproar and excitement in the recent polls for these politicians. And I guess when we discuss this, we want to really be clear or form connections if really the Democrats are that different from the Republicans when it comes to this issue. A lot of, you know, liberal friends seem to think that there is a difference. But I think given the topic that we'll have, I'm sure we'll have our form our own opinions about that and share that with the public. I'll say a little bit, just to give context, right? Okay. So Israel during this time has given, has made lots of visits here in the USA with Donald Trump, and been discussing along with one of the advisors, Trump's advisors, Jared Kushner, some form of Israel and Palestine conflict peace deal. Well, part of that peace deal comes with the annexation of the occupied side of the West Bank, where the Jordan River is looked at as one of the most resourceful natural areas. And even though I would say that annexation versus the occupation, I mean, it was going to lead to that, but and the occupation is still a terrible fate for the Palestinian people. However, this annexation will certainly put it on paper of the constant attack that there is on the Palestinian people from the from Israel, and yes, it has been mostly been now supported by the USA, especially with Trump's encouragement for the embassy from Tel Aviv move over to Jerusalem. I would say, though, that there is, I have some suspicions about this new pact, this new deal with the United Arab Emirates, because this is the first time, in my knowledge, at least from my understanding, that this is the first time that it actually has been public in their show of support or allianceship for the first time, but has been made many deals to counter Iran way before this. And I don't really think this is a pact. I think really Israel is feeling the heat, especially from European nations, to for the annexation to happen. So in my opinion, I do think that this is just theater. It's just a way to show that Israel and the United Arab Emirates are unifying for public display or the optics of it. I do think that there is some other political game going on, which we can discuss before then, later. However, I think it would be wise for us to discuss the plight of the Palestinian people, because as we had actually discussed in an episode before, and you know, the Palestinian people really have been occupied for a very long time, and even in an open air prison, apartheid region. It just keeps getting worse, and the support of Israel to extend its borders is, I think, something that we need to have. What do you call it, Andy? We had this mutual support. No, it's not mutual support. It's show our solidarity with our brothers and sisters, the working class folks that are on the other side of the world. Even though I know mostly on this episode, we focus on socialist movements or uprisings to happen here. We try to concentrate here. But let's not forget that the struggle outside of these borders is still a working class issue. And I think internationally, as workers, we should still stand united with whoever is in their struggle. And I think we are like that, the three of us here. We're really in support of that. I would like to also just call out, if I may, just the hypocrisy of just liberals, as I said earlier, for now making this a progressive issue when we have PAC money or we have support groups here, Democrats mostly, trying to prop up this Israeli support and genocide of the Palestinian people. So I think that that's, I'll just give that for now. And maybe we can discuss and dissect anything that I have said or disagreements that both of you have had, have with me. That's all right. So we can share anything that's on your mind.
Yeah, I mean, I have a question, you know, like when this thing happened, this agreement, you know, the United Arab Emirates and, you know, Israel, two seemingly opposite sides, right? Supposedly at war or in opposition to each other. You know, it's being touted as a big deal. And so my question immediately is, you know, as to what does this mean? Like, who gets what? And obviously we know that politicians or ruling class, they don't make a move without thought, you know? And so this obviously came more like the most obvious reason is that this came at the foot of the Democratic Convention, you know? And so it is, it ties back to our politics. You know, it is an optics issue for the Republicans, I think. But beyond that, I want to kind of get into, you know, what does this mean for Israel? What does this mean for the U.S., for the United Arab Emirates, and for the region as a whole? And yeah, so those are my kind of my initial questions.
Well, I have some thoughts about a lot of the things that are said. So I'm going to try to start with my thoughts on Palestine and the plight of the Palestinians and the resistance of the Palestinians, but where that comes from. So Palestinians were on they lived in regions that are now called Israel back in the 40s, and the establishment of Israel meant the pushing out of those of people who were there into regions like the West Bank and Gaza, as well as other parts of the Middle East. And that was till 1967. And then after 1967, Israel went even further and occupied the places that these essentially Palestinian refugees were staying in the West Bank and Gaza. And so you have people. The Palestinian plight has not just been one of, hey, don't occupy us. It's been the right of return. It's been, you kicked us off our lands. It's like the plight of the Native Americans. It's like the plight of indigenous people in a lot of countries. But these indigenous people have not been crushed yet, so we haven't completely forgotten about it. Their plight is one of saying, we were kicked off our lands unjustly, but we live in essentially an apartheid regime because we don't have the same rights. We don't have the same rights. Palestinians in Israel don't have the same rights because Israel ultimately gives most rights. They don't recognize Israeli nationality. They recognize Jewish nationality as having those predominant rights. And that's why it's a Zionist state. It's a racist state just for Jews. And it says we're for Jews everywhere, but it displaces and doesn't allow the same rights for Palestinians and Arabs who live in the region. And of course, Palestinians who are in the occupied regions are essentially like living in a Warsaw ghetto, but in some cases worse. And the Palestinians have faced two victims in the region. They faced the Israeli oppressors directly. And I thought there was an interesting Jewish leftist, I can't remember her name, but who basically said, it is apartheid, but apartheid in South Africa was about using black labor cheap and using apartheid to extract black labor cheap. She goes, that's not what's happening here in Israel. This is more like apartheid that's whose project is about genocide, whose project is about just get rid of you. We don't need you for cheap labor. We don't need you at all. We're going to do a slow genocide and just try to get rid of you altogether. So it's actually not an apartheid of exploitation. It's an apartheid whose aim is genocide. And I agree with that. That's the Israeli project for the Palestinians. But the Palestinians don't just have a problem with Israel. They have a problem with all these Arab monarchies because their cause has been used by these Arab monarchies. And so Israel, to me, plays this game of like, and Israel relies on the United States to do this and has said to the United States, if you support us in what we're doing, we'll be your watchdog in the Middle East and we'll take on any problem you have here if you allow us or need us to. And they kind of sometimes strangle the Palestinians and threaten strangling the Palestinians to get US to say, okay, let us do this. Or they go ahead and go after some of the Arab regimes directly and take them down. They did it recently in Sudan. And I think there's been recent evidence of Israel acting directly in Iran. But Israel has a long tradition of helping the United States take down nationalist regimes in the Middle East, regimes that think that those they can run their own countries and don't want to rely on the United States. So those regimes have also used the Palestinian cause though as well and said, no, we're going to support the Palestinian cause. Stay with us, people. You know, whether you're from Bahrain or Saudi Arabia or Omar or United Arab Emirates, those monarchies often they know how much support the people in their own countries have for the Palestinian cause. So they say we're for the Palestinians. We're going to help them, but it's a complete lie. They're for themselves. They're for whoever can cut the best deal. And so, what has slowly been happening since these various quote peace accords? Whether it would be a key peace accord that was struck with Egypt back in the time of Carter, or so-called peace accord, the Oslo Accord, that allowed, I think, Jordan that meant Egypt was saying, hey, we'll recognize Israel. Recognizing Israel means that essentially says, you were right to steal the Palestinian, or you're okay with stealing the Palestinian land. Just don't take the rest of that stuff. Just don't maybe annex that. Well, it's been happening anyway. People, even after the Egypt deal, Israel continued to move in and establish settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. The Oslo Accords in the 90s had the same sort of thing. They were talked about as peace. It's not peace. It's peace at the expense of the Palestinians. And this, it was called the Abraham Accord, I think. It's the same one. But I don't think it's just theater. I do think that we're seeing well, there is an election element to this for Netanyahu and for Trump to basically seem like peace people. Again, this is not peace, this is war. But the target and the victims will be the Palestinians directly because they weren't involved in any of the agreements here. They were never involved in any of the accords. They were never at the table with UAE or Israel or United States. But the real the most pressing target is actually Iran because everyone is recognizing that US is now going to establish Israel as its primary way of putting pressure on Iran, but now it's going to line up, you know, it has Egypt, it has Jordan, United Arab Emirates, there's talk of next Bahrain and Oman, and then even Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia said, no, we don't agree with this thing, but Jared Kushner pretty much said they expect, and even people in Israel have said they expect Saudi Arabia to eventually fall in line and also recognize Israel. And why is that happening? Because Iran is standing on the other side as a threat. And why is Iran a threat? And this was interesting to me. I did not know this. At least why is it perceived as a threat? We all know that, you know, Iran has sort of been sticking its thumb in the, in the eye of the United States. But I don't know. I found this out only recently, is that Iran and China only last month reached a pretty historic deal of trade, of military exercise together. Basically, China looks to be making a play so that China will be with Iran like the United States is with Israel. China's talking about investing $400 billion over 25 years in Iran, establishing military bases in certain sections, establishing 5G networks, and they do this with the promise of getting cheap oil from Iran. And this allows Iran to get outside of the sanctions that the United States has put on it, and now they have somebody they can trade with. So what you're seeing, yes, this is a elections thing, but what you are seeing is the fracturing we've been talking about nationally, the growing tensions between the big global powers, and it's ramping up. Israel is going to be on one side, and the forces that want to be around the United States and think that they're going to protect them are going to assemble around them. And you're going to see China using Iran and Russia, I do think is getting in with them as well. Yeah. Is going to start to say, no, we're going to be on the other side. So you're starting to see the actual, not just fractures, you can begin to see the lines of conflict. And in fact, there was an Iranian general who was quoted as saying, once this deal was struck with China, he basically said, the U.S. is not going to mess with this anymore. Because now we got them on our back. We got them with us. They're making a base right in the Strait of Hormuz that's going to have Chinese ships and Chinese paid for Chinese ports right there controlling oil. But ultimately, that's going to come into conflict with the United States and their Sixth Fleet, which is doing the same thing. So the U.S., China's making a big play here. It's what I know. I mean, it should be expected, but I just think that's the real story here, is that this is a reflection of growing tensions, of growing warlike posturing between, not posturing, like it's fake, it's real, between China and the United States. And that's what I think is really the biggest thing. And that's why Joe Biden had to say this, as you mentioned, the liberals are, here's what Joe Biden said about what is essentially an act of war. That's what US is doing, because they're trying to align up everyone with Israel so they can go after Iran, which means they're going after China. And instead of Joe Biden calling this out or saying, oh, we shouldn't support Israel and all that kind of stuff, he said, Joe Biden's response was this. He said, I personally spent time with leaders of both Israel and the UAE during our administration, building the case for cooperation and broader engagement. I am gratified by today's announcement. So he's trying to play catch up a little bit, but I do think this was a big deal for Trump. I think it's a big deal for the United States. And it's a big deal for workers who are worried about World War III. That's how I read this right now.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, like, if you notice the deals that are done between China and North Korea, or even Russia with North Korea, or, you know, they're just forming these gangs of making sure that if there is going to be a World War III, you have your team players set up, aligned with whoever is going to, because ultimately this is going to be catastrophic, where whatever is going to ignite, whatever is the thing that's going to ignite this World War III, they're going to be prepared for it. And that is gaining that support. No one is just going to leave Iran, and that is an opportunity there, right? I know that there was support from Russia as well, in Iran as well, Trump broke off with the deal with Iran that Obama had done with them. We did an episode, I want to remind folks, if we covered the whole Iran deal that people can look back at, and it'll be in the notes below. So yes, I'm agreement with you. I really do think Russia is going to be involved. It's not only just in Iran, it's also in Africa, where China is also putting a lot of investment in. I've noticed there has been a lot of investment there for different reasons other than oil. Iran definitely has those wells of oil. But I think it's just, again, this monopolization to gain that control, that power. And yes, I'm in agreement with the Palestinian people cross, hit, no, when bullets fly.
The crosshairs of two forces, the Israelis and the Arab.
But regime. There is a word, there's a the, when you are in the crossfire.
Oh, yeah.
In the crossfire, that's the word. Anyhow, yeah. And when Joe Biden, if he does become the president, I don't think that there will be any Palestinian support as they're making it out to be, because Israel has so much. There's just this it's so much embedded within that within the Democratic Party to support Israel. Even Nancy Pelosi was like, "We're never going to stop supporting it, Israel." And they I forget what the pact is called, the one where you go to that some people decided not to go to. I know AOC decided not to go to it. What's that pact? Do you both remember? Just quickly, I wanted to mention, call out the pact that gives to the Democratic Party, which is supported by Israel. Huh?
Yeah, AIPAC. The it stands for American Israeli Public Affairs Committee.
Yeah. So that's one of the Democratic lobby ship from Israel. So it's all just, you know, it's just so embedded. There's just all of this going on, and again, the Palestinian people are all affected by it.
Yeah, I was just thinking of Iran and. You know, how despite embargoes, despite the constant threat, you know, we talked in the previous episode of how Iran is surrounded by military bases, U.S. military bases, that it's been able to resist a lot of the pressure. And it makes sense that China would, you know, make a move there because, you know, for aspirations of having a bigger presence in the world. And something that we're often not doesn't get discussed is that Iran is topographically, it's like it's protected more than Iraq, for example. And there are a lot more people in Iran that are more committed and more homogeneous. You know, the factions aren't as exploitable as other areas. So going after Iran militarily, even though a lot of, you know, the U.S. posture, you know, pressuring Iran is not a smart move. You know, that would mean a lot more casualties, and it would take a bigger effort than it took in Iraq. I just kind of wanted to bring this up because, you know, Iran is not, it's not Iraq, basically. That it would really take a big commitment to go after Iran. I don't know. I just wanted to just bring it up because I think it's one of the factors as to why Iran is still standing. and now, from what you said, Lipson, having China on its side, you know, obviously being corralled for so long. And also I was thinking about Soleimani, you know, that move that the U.S. made, you know, the bold move of killing one of the top generals. It forces their hand, too, to make a big move to protect themselves. And, you know, the escalation just... it seems to be the only way here.
I just wanted to say that if we look as well as we're talking about, like, the formation of these nations grouping to be able to, should World War III does come, any time, whether it be the USA or Russia now with Belarus, where there is a massive uprising right now, and Russia wants to take over that support that the government there to again make it a part of their cohort. It is all form of colonization, but the USA has always done it. And any time the USA is out there criticizing, it is so hypocritical because they're always doing it. And so I just think that when we're looking at when U.S. Americans out looking internationally and criticizing other countries for that, we need to see how this country is doing that as well. And why is it all right for Iran not for the USA to have nuclear weapons but not Iran? I'm not saying I support it, right? I'm not, but But why is it all right? Why are we saying, sometimes I enter in these discussions with people and they say, well, they have to disarm themselves. Well, we have to disarm ourselves as well. I think we really have to call out the USA for their nuclear weapons and their armory. And yet we're always looking at other countries for what they need to do and disarm them and sanction them and keep them as the USA dictates, because this is a very imperialistic country. But that's not the rhetoric that is said when, at least in the circles that I'm in, when they're criticizing other countries. They're not talking about the USA, they're talking about the disarmament of other countries, Syria or Iran or, I just thought I'd give that tidbit.
I mean, the most dangerous nuclear power on the globe is the United States. And they're the only ones who've used nuclear weapons, and they use depleted nuclear weapons. They've irradiated all the Middle East and Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, millions of years of half-life of low-level radiation across the globe. So the most dangerous nuclear power, the power that needs to be taken down, that needs to be sanctioned and taken down, is the United States. To the extent that Iran has been able to be somewhat safe from the United States, I think there's two major factors. I don't think it's their people or their military or their terrain per se. I mean, I think the biggest thing was the resistance in Iraq and the resistance in Afghanistan. It's the Taliban and ISIS that kept the people in Iran safe. And it wasn't the U.S. anti-war movement. It was the Taliban and ISIS that saved the Iranian people from certain destruction. Rumsfeld said, you know, yeah, we can go after Iraq and Afghanistan, but real men go to Israel, go to Iran. They had every intention of taking Iran down right after but it was these forces that they had called ISIS and you notice we aren't hearing about them anymore, right? They were such a big deal. Now we don't hear about them anymore. But it was the resistance in those regions, the military resistance, that was making trouble for U.S., that, yes, killed U.S. soldiers, blew up things, who gave their lives way more than they killed, to be honest, that made the U.S. stumble in the region, and so they had to delay their efforts to take down Iran, which is what they planned on doing. And the reality is that, I mean, for me, if the U.S. goes after Iran, I'm for Iran defeating the United States in a war, because I want the U.S. to lose this war, because we need to take our own government down. That's my feeling. The thing that's happening now with the rise of China is that no emerging power, Venezuela or Iran, is just going to sit there and be like, okay, you won't let me get your nuclear weapons? Now people are going to start to line up with different forces. And this is how, this is going to create the situation around the globe. We don't know where the conflict will break out, but increasingly the world is going to be divided up between China, Russia, and maybe Europe and the US ruling class. And you're going to have to find out who your protector is. And that's how this world is going to be divided. And historically, yes, I think revolutionaries and socialists have supported national liberation movements, even if they're not socialist. But we're going to find less and less of those kinds of movements, because all of them are going to have their international, their imperial power that's bankrolling them. I still want the U.S. to lose any war it enters, all right? And so if the U.S. forces a war in Iran that brings China in, my job is to get the U.S. to lose and bring down. That's our job. U.S. workers' job is to bring down our government and get our side to lose before they press the nuclear button. All right. It's called turn imperialist war into civil war. It's called revolutionary defeatism, which is something that Lenin had talked about, and I agree with it. But that's the world that's being constructed right now. There aren't going to be, and I understand what Iran is doing. It makes sense. They have been attacked. In fact, they're in the end of June, one of their missile sites was blown up. I think sometime in July, one of their nuclear facilities was blown up. They had a hospital blown up that people were saying maybe there was nuclear stuff there. People believe that was Israel. Now, Iran is trying to say, no, that's not Israel. And I think Iran is trying to play a game of like, we know if we can establish this thing with China that we can get ourselves on a better footing. And Israel's playing its standard game, which is, United States, we will mess with anybody you need us to mess with to help your cause, as long as you support us and give us support in whatever we do. We'll be your watchdog. And in fact, there's a an interesting quote that goes back to the 40s or 50s that came out of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, which said this. And that this quote to me establishes the relationship of Israel, because some people say, oh, Israel or AIPAC is running the United States. Completely wrong. Israel is at the beck and call of the United States, and they have a symbiotic relationship, but the director is the United States. And so this is what the Haaretz newspaper said. They wrote, the West is none too happy about its relations with the states in the Middle East because nationalist regimes were coming up. The feudal regimes that make such concessions to the nationalist movements that have become more and more reluctant to supply Britain and the United States with their natural resources and military bases. Therefore, strengthening Israel helps the Western powers maintain equilibrium and stability in the Middle East. Israel is to become the watchdog. There is no fear that Israel will undertake any aggressive policy towards the Arab states when they would explicitly contradict the wishes of the US and Britain. But if for any reason the Western powers should sometimes prefer to close their eyes, Israel could be relied on to punish one or several neighboring states whose discourtesy to the West went beyond the bounds of the permissible. This is back in the 50s. That's been the relationship of the US and Israel, and it's grown as the United States empire has grown, the British Empire receded, and as the fortunes of the US in the Middle East has grown. So to me, that thing that was written in the 50s of Israel being the watchdog and saying, we'll go bite who you need us to bite, and we will threaten to take out the Palestinians and use that as a lever to form relations with the Arab regimes. The Palestinians are being used as pawns by both sides.
What else can be said? It is sad what is going on right now. I think that the Palestinian people have been through in most recent times, especially in the constant struggle to reclaim their land or to reclaim at least a lot of shared space that they need to be able to live, you know, with the Israelis. I think it's important that we give them, it's not my struggle, but that the Israelis be the persecution of Palestinians cease. And I mean, what else more is there to say about that? I don't know how people could, the Democrats, namely, and liberals that I always feel that are not, I've had this discussion with teachers before, my friends, and they seem to think it's all right for the Israelis to go after in the name of protection. So, I mean, it's just a sad situation.
I'm more curious about where does Russia fit into this game? Because, you know, we've loosely talked about how maybe there's a divide in the ruling class in the U.S. as to who to go first, right? Like, you know, China, Russia. And so where is Russia's play here?
That's a good question. For the longest time, I've thought more of Iran as an ally of Russia than China.
Yeah. And
I do believe it seems like Russia supports or is okay with what's going on with this new China agreement with Iran, but it seems like they're getting pushed out of a major, like Russia has been able to be a player in the Middle East, largely in its relationship with Iran and Syria and places like that. So that's a good question. I don't know how they factor in.
Yeah, no, I was just curious, because I mean, in the past, obviously it's been major conflicts where the US and Russia had, you know, head-to-head proxy wars.
I suspect, if you ask me to guess, I suspect that with the U.S. encircling both China and Russia, that I don't think Russia minds China putting this kind of military and political pressure on the United States in that region. I think it takes the pressure off of, it gives Russia a freer hand to exercise their imperialist kind of role if they need to. So that's what I suspect, but I'm really kind of guessing.
Yeah. And it also makes me wonder as to, you know, it seems like Russia might be like this third, you know, imperial power, I guess, behind the US and China. And, you know, as So, you know, we see how China is influencing great parts of the world, mainly financially, bankrolling a lot of things and projects. And whereas Russia, where is Russia now? I mean, what is their goal? Is it just survival, maybe?
I think they have their eyes focused on Belarus right now.
Yeah.
It's my opinion.
Yeah.
But with what's going on there, I mean, if you're talking about in general, they're always looking for opportunity as well, right? And also just extending Putin's reign that was supposed to expire, I think, in 2024. And with the new elections that happened just recently, that was mostly their concentration, and giving out, I think, free cars to people to vote for him, which now has extended his rulership. So I think mostly the Kremlin has focused on the recent elections, COVID, and as of right now, recently, I think also just Belarus. And I don't know. That's it. No.
One angle that we didn't talk about was the elections, because you mentioned it, Eduardo. I do think that the elections figure, I mean, I do think there's a big geopolitical play here, but I think the elections figure into it as well. And to me,
the USA elections.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you. The US elections, that Netanyahu and Trump are trying to help each other actively get each other elected. Now, then there's been so much talk of Russia intervening elections and China. You want to talk about intervening elections. This is intervening. This is what it looks like, folks, when big powers intervene in elections. They make plays like this. They make plays in June and August, or July and August, 2 months prior to an election, and it shifts polls, okay? It's not troll farms, all right? This is what it looks like.
This is not the episode for that right now, Andy.
Sorry, Eduardo, I had to throw that in. But this is what it looks like when big powers intervene. And this has happened before. Like in 1980, when Reagan was trying to get elected, they agreed with Iran. Like Iran basically said, we'll wait till you get elected, and then we'll release the hostages. You know, that's intervening in your elections. Okay, this Russia gate, China gate, whatever kind of crap that's going to be, that's still a bunch of nonsense. The reason the elections aren't going to be fraudulent is because the Department of Homeland Security is controlling your elections, and they're not going to give you. They're going to decide for you who your president is, and that's going to be decided by who raises the most money and who the capitalist caste gets behind. And right now, the capitalists, I think, are starting to like Trump a little bit more because they're seeing he's delivering. I think his plan makes a little more sense to him now. That's my feeling.
Yeah.
So you're starting to see this. I'm getting this sense that, you know, you're not sure yet as to.
I am.
Come up on top.
Yeah. Because my own figures. Look, I thought that Bernie Sanders was going to be the presidential candidate. So obviously don't listen to me about election stuff, but I go up and down with the polls.
I'm beginning to think that Joe Biden might win. It's just, of course it makes no difference, right? We've discussed this last episode, but I'm just saying that because I had thought originally that maybe Trump would win, but I just see now when I say win, I'm talking about the popular vote. I cannot predict the electoral vote.
Yeah,
of course you and I have a difference in there, don't we, Andy?
We do.
You don't think the popular vote?
I think these things are made up now that it's electronic voting. I really do. I don't believe these numbers. And I think in 2016, I think the ruling class actually tried to gin their system to actually get Trump to lose, and they just didn't do it well enough. And they were very surprised when they tried by election fraud methods to get Clinton in, and they lost. So they haven't recovered since then. And I mean, now they have, because now I feel like
it's a lot of fake votes, Andy.
Yeah, no, made up votes. It's not fake votes. It's electronic now. Like, this is.
I have an issue with that. I take issue to it because it's. I wouldn't That how many more? 3 million votes more than Trump?
Yeah.
As the popular vote?
That's what the machines revealed. How these votes, what happened when people pulled levers or put little arrows to things? And what connection is to that, to those numbers? I don't think those are connected. I don't. I think our election system is 100% penetrated by ruling class interests that have gotten control of this electronic balloting. I don't believe any of these numbers.
Well, maybe we can discuss that as we get closer to November elections, because I'd like to see your receipts, or your, not receipts, your information, your proof.
Well, you can just, there is stuff around the Democratic national primaries from 2016 and 2020. And, you know, that's the biggest one is polls, exit polls coming in or going out, and then them not lining up with the actual numbers. And then they stop even exit polling altogether. That's the definition for election fraud, is when those things are off by 2 or 3%. And
wasn't the 2 or 3% though?
Yeah, they are. They have been off by the exit polls, or they stopped exit polling. So yeah, I don't buy it.
All right, well, we'll save that. I'll write it down as a possible topic for next time. Troll farming, hacking, and whether ballots are really counted or not. And we're talking specifically of the popular vote.
Yeah, I mean, I don't believe that popular vote in 2016. I don't know. Maybe Hillary Clinton. I don't know. I just don't believe it. So.
Well, maybe you should tell us with paperwork rather than than just saying it like that. And it's hard for me to just buy what you say sometimes. I don't know what areas of the internet you're looking into these days. Anyhow, went off.
Yeah, I mean, regardless, I think we've said that at least that it doesn't matter. We're still gonna have to fight, you know, whoever's sitting in that office. And you know, this is something that you know, people want to convince themselves often, at least liberal friends, that, you know, somehow just getting the optics and, you know, like the Trump out of their face actually, there was this comment that I responded to recently online, someone who has a lot of influence online. But basically they said that, you know, it doesn't matter who wins, but basically they argue that if we get the Democrats out, they're more easily pressured. And I responded, actually, I disagree with that. It's probably the contrary, you know, because we on the left generally go belly up real quick with our parties, you know. Not to say that we can't influence Trump either, or, you know, whoever's really sitting, you know, in that sense, you know, people are wondering whether I'm going to vote or not. It doesn't matter. Or, you know, go vote if you want. It's symbolic, you know. But the real work doesn't come from that. You know, if that is your extent of your political activity, then we're in deep trouble. You know, I don't know if this is where we kind of talk about the Democrats and how bold they've become, you know, with military action and policing people. I am actually scared, you know, of what may come once if Trump loses, you know, we will get rolled over even more, you know, because a lot of people will slow down and, you know, and not want to see the obvious monster that this, you know, ruling class is. And pretend, you know, that it's all copacetic and you know.
You say something similar to Andy, who has said that voting for a Democrat just slows the movement down towards the opposite, because similar to that. No, Andy, am I wrong?
Sure. No, it's a different problem. It poses a different problem to the working class. That's what I would say. Mm-hmm. We have two different problems. They're the same problem, but they pose different kinds of challenges to the working class.
Right, but the different problem would be that people as Kenny is saying, would stop almost in fighting as hard, no?
Well, like when
just
the administration with a black vice president starts throwing more black people in jail, people give it a pass, or puts more or supports more immigrants, people give it a pass because the color representation is in identity politics basically says, well, at least it's not really racially motivated. It's just bad policy. No, it's just as racist, because it's just racism driven with a different face. Mm-hmm. Because the racism isn't coming from the face or coming from the skin. It's coming from the institutions.
Yeah.
And I think that it's important to note, if we just look at how the Democratic Convention has been inviting Republicans, it just shows solidarity between Republicans and Democrats. So when people ask me, why aren't you voting for a Democratic candidate? I think it makes it easy now with the Democratic Convention just to point out their shared vision. You know, Joe Biden and, you know, that the people that are there in his team and everyone, they're not a threat necessarily to the status quo. Yeah. And so I think it's just easier today, easier right now, just because we're talking about these elections, to show that there is a really, they're in cahoots.
Yeah, you know, on the note of the Democratic Convention, it's not an obvious that, you know, they are flaunting their menu of identities on liberals. You know, they've even brought in, like you said, Colin Powell, you know, fucking murderer, and, you know, in to speak on behalf, you know, of the Democratic Party. They have Hillary Clinton obviously speaking about, you know, feminism and things like that. AOC, even though she pretends, or maybe she believes it, you know, that she's her symbolic nomination of Bernie Sanders, yet she's still in the party. You know, she, with the massive support that she has, she could potentially move out of the party, and if it really was about anti-establishment stuff. But here she is leading people in, you know, with her being a rebel, you know, within the party. But in reality, she's, you know, her function is to keep people in the party. And, you know, Michelle Obama too, you know, in the personality cult politics on the liberal side, you know, Michelle Obama, you know, she can't do no wrong. And actually one of your favorite commentators, what is it, Carlson? But they were destroying Michelle Obama, and, you know, as to how culty, and she was being compared to the Scientology leader, you know, and basically highlighting the cult. And it's like, at least from my side, that's not really off base. Mm-hmm. You know, like a lot of the left operates in that manner, that willing to overlook, you know, these things, and it takes more effort to convince yourself that the Democrats are, you know, somewhat better than, you know, saying fuck with them all, you know, like, I don't know. I think it takes a lot of energy to argue those points, you know, and to spin this ticket, even, you know, the Biden Kamala Harris ticket. But here we are, you know, everyone's getting in line, and again, to quote Michelle Obama, which kind of make reference to her, she basically was saying, you know, shame on you if you vote against a candidate that can't win. You know, shame on you if you don't get someone else in line. You know, and obviously she said it with nice things, but that's scary, again, because that is how we fall in line, you know, against ourselves ultimately, and in line with the people that will lead us to war, into these conflicts, you know, that will arise, and we have no say right now onto what happens. And it's scary. I mean, it's a scary future, I think.
One last thing, I think, if I may, about the Democratic, they invited someone, I forget the name of the person that was invited, that basically created the myth that there were weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East, in Iraq. that was part of the Bush administration and invited him to speak at a Democratic convention.
You put a bunch of never-Trumpers up there.
Huh?
They've invited a bunch of never-Trump Republicans.
Yeah. I thought that is my reason alone. I mean, there are many reasons, but that I think I could just shove into people's face to say, this is who you want me to be aligned with. You know, when we have been murdering people for now 19 years out in Iraq based on lies, and this is the person they're coming to bring to the podium to speak for the Democratic, for or represent or to speak to against Trump and allyship with the Democrats. I just thought, no.
I mean, I guess to maybe try to bring it back to what we were talking about, full circle, Israel, Palestinians, and the Arab monarchies. And I said the Palestinian people had no friend with the Israelis. Palestinian workers have no friend with the Israelis, the Israeli government, or the Arab monarchies. And the U.S. working class faces the same situation, has no friend with Republicans and no friend with the Democratic Party. They're caught in the crosshairs, like you said, crossfire between two, and they're squeezed by both sides and played by both sides at the expense of the Palestinian workers and the expense of the U.S. workers here. That's what happens here. It all happens at our expense. But I also, there's been a discussion for a while, actually, among socialists, and there was a famous debate between Rosa Luxemburg and Lenin about national liberation struggles and what should be your attitude. And I do believe socialists support all national liberation struggles. But as I think about things, I do think the space for national liberation struggles is shrinking because I do see the world and globe increasingly being locked up between the big powers, and all the smaller colonial countries have to find some big power, nuclear-powered benefactor. And what's in it for the big powers is they get to fight their wars on somebody else's territory. They get to have the casualties. They get to fight the war, but have the casualties be Iranian, or the casualties be Israelis, or the casualties be Palestinians, or the casualties be Saudi Arabian workers. We'll have those people die and have their countries be irradiated while we figure out between the Chinese ruling class and US ruling class, who's gonna control the globe. And so for me, just as we are moving more inexorably towards conflict, which looks like it could lead to the kinds of things that led to World War III, I do feel like the space, we're running out of time and we're running out of space to like have these small struggles or struggles that do small defeats. Like, I feel like the stakes are getting higher. And to me, it looks more and more like it's either going to be socialist revolution in the Middle East, that is Palestinian. And I do believe Israeli workers have to figure, and there's a debate there as well, whether Israeli workers would ever benefit from a socialist revolution. I actually think they would. But all the workers in the Middle East are going to have a socialist revolution that takes down all their respective ruling classes. And that's the only solution at this point. I don't see any other way. I don't see a national liberation struggle in one nation that doesn't use that as the foothold for a socialist revolution that's supposed to spread. I don't see that kind of thing happening. Even Hezbollah right now, really, is Hezbollah is linked to Iran. Iran is linked to China. No one's independent any longer. Or increasingly, I don't know if I can find any independent movements. So it raises a question for me. That doesn't change where I'm at. I'm not about saying we got to fight China. I'm about we have to fight our ruling class. But the notion that these just national liberation struggles that are not dedicated towards establishing international socialism are going to achieve anything, I feel like we're running out of space. I think that the need for socialist revolution, the need for that to be articulated somewhere, is even more desperate. And I think we're farther away from it than we've ever been, not just in this country, but I think anywhere international. That's good news.
I guess, what would you say to someone that would argue, if it's not us, it's someone else? And, you know, basically the reform is, you know, couldn't we make our own thing better, you know, or make it more benevolent?
Good luck. That just means supporting our own side in war. And there's no future in that, because it's going to lead to a global conflagration. Like, it is going to be us. It's going to be us in a nuclear war with another power. And the only way to stop it is to stop our government. To say, think we're going to stop it by going after and fighting the Chinese, that's actually saying, there's a fire going here, I'm going to bring some gas to it. You actually have to put water on the fire. And water means you have to, that water has to be thrown on your own ruling class. There's no other way.
And isn't nuclear conflict part of the past? You know, like the Russian and the U.S., you know, Soviet Union, the U.S. What tells you that, you know, we are under that threat, you know?
Well, because the U.S. ruling class thinks they're under that threat. That's why they're doing this stuff with, like, that's why they're, I believe, that's why they're doing all this surveillance stuff and data mining, distance learning. This is an attempt to compete with China under the conditions of the fourth industrial revolution to see who's going to run the globe. So that's the reason I think it's a threat is what it looks like. And this is what the U.S. ruling class is saying in their own papers. They're the ones saying we're preparing for global war. Their national strategic documents say it. Their smaller time stuff says it. They're worried. And they think they've got 20 or 30 years to get this figured out, or else China as an economy or a military, or at least its development of AI, is not going to be assailable. So they figure, I think they think they've got about 30 years to figure out how to get China back into a defeated box. That's how I hear them talking about it. And they also have scenarios where they think we could win limited nuclear war. Good luck with that.
Well, on that note, very sad, pessimistic, and dystopian future note, I think we should end here. Well, if that's all right.
That's fine. What do you think about that, Kenny? Does that seem like an answer? I don't know.
I don't know. No, just curious, you know, because I personally, you know, yeah, you know, some people feel like, you know, demoralized or hopeless about, you know, any possibility of changing anything. And at least from my perspective, you know, I have no other choice but to keep fighting and figure out, you know, or sit down and you know, wait for someone else to determine all of your life. And so, yeah, I mean, maybe to kind of switch the mood, like I've said this in the past, like, you know, I believe that, you know, I've learned this from you, Lipson, from Brian, that we are the bearers of bad news, you know, but I think that in there is hope, you know, that we want something better and we expect better, and that, you know, just gotta keep pushing and keep pushing the train and maybe it'll move someday. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know, you know, I don't know how this will play out. I don't know if we'll ever push back enough, but, you know, can lose hope that, because it's being evidence, you know, it is contagious. You know, when people see success, people see, you know, even that's probably the one lesson I've learned from the Black Lives Matter movement, even if it's as misguided as it is, mm-hmm. as limited in scope as it is, people have risen up, you know, and it may just take one, you know, to kind of ignite the fire, because people are fed up, you know, the world, people are rising up in different ways and manifesting their anger. But I don't know. What I'm saying is that, you know, I'll keep pushing and I hope, you know, more people do.
Well, people better start reading. That's all I can say. And I know you are having a group that's reading Daniel De Leon, Reformer Revolution. You know, you better start reading things like that. You better start reading Communist Manifesto, Lenin's Imperialism, or State and Revolution. And you better start asking yourself, does what these folks are writing describe the world we're living in? If it doesn't, then okay, it's not useful. But if it does, then I think there's a bit of a guide for what's going to have to happen. But if people think that they're gonna, that we're gonna be better off trying to fight China, you know, or trying to side with our ruling class, I mean, good luck. You know, frankly, our data under TikTok is safer with the Communist Party than it is with Google. For me, I mean, what's the CP gonna do? You know? But there's no winner there for me. Both, the whole system's got to be taken down.
But I do appreciate the conversation. And I think Kenny is bringing up something that I think is on everyone's mind, especially if you're going to be, if you pledge to be a socialist. I think, where is the struggle aiming towards if the forces, the powers that be are very, very strong, right? And to keep up that struggle, to find the inspiration, the energy, the just the drive to continue, it is challenging. And it falls on us. It falls on the working class. And we have a lot already on our plate. So I can just see how it is challenging just to keep going. Mm-hmm. All right. But that's why we're going to do a socialist panel. And we're going to talk about what can we do more than just voting at the ballot box. All right, let's conclude this episode, if that's all right. That does it for this week's episode. What's Left is a weekly political podcast that's channel challenging the mainstream left. We post information about our topics and our guests on the episode notes, wherever you found this episode, or on our blog at what-s-left.webnode.com. You can find past episodes to this podcast last channel there and connect with us. I remind folks, if you fancy anything that you've heard here, please share your favorite episode, rate, review, and subscribe to any of our 6 platforms on Spotify, iTunes Podcast, Stitcher, Google Play, BitChute, or YouTube. And if you would like to give us feedback about something you've heard or suggest something for us to cover, contact us through our blog. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-hosts Andy Lipson and Kenny Cepeda. See you all next time. Stay safe. Wash your hands. The virus is not a hoax. I'm Eduardo Arca, Kenny Cepeda, and Andy Lipson. Take care. Ciao.